My pleasure to introduce our first speaker of the day, which is Dr. Mark Brugneris. I had the opportunity to review Dr. Brugneris' newest book, Premarital Sex in America, How Young Americans Meet, Mate, and Think About Marrying. And the book marries, if you will, large survey data with interviews with young Americans between the ages of 18 and 23. The book is an insightful examination of what young adults believe and hope for while challenging some myths and some preconceived conceptions. The material Dr. Brugneris explores in his new book has deep implications for the future of marriage in North America, and his book certainly does touch on that. Dr. Brugneris is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Texas at Austin, and he holds the position of faculty research associate of the university's Population Research Center. Before co-authoring Premarital Sex in America, he wrote Forbidden Fruit, Sex and Religion in the Lives of American Teenagers, published in 2007. And Forbidden Fruit reveals the complexity of teenagers' sexual decision-making, documenting religion's effects, that religion affects the sexual attitudes, but that it does not often motivate the decisions to act. Instead, religion often accompanies other secular reasons for delaying sex, like concern for safeguarding one's educational future. Forbidden Fruit describes this largely religionless, middle-class sexual morality in detail and concludes with a new typology for documenting how religion shapes human action among adolescents and adults. And you can certainly understand how these two books are connected, and in fact, I believe Premarital Sex in America sort of carries on from where Forbidden Fruit left off. Well, Dr. Brugneris, his work has been featured in numerous media outlets, including The New Yorker, Dallas Morning News, New York Times, Washington Times, Time Magazine, Psychology Today, The New Republic, and across the pond in The Daily Mail and The Guardian. He's also written op-eds and short articles for the publications like Slate, in addition to over 30 academic articles and book chapters. And here in Canada, Dr. Brugneris has appeared on The Agenda with Steve Paikin and was the subject earlier this spring of a feature interview in Maclean's magazine. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Mark Brugneris.
It's good to be with you today. I appreciate the invitation, and I want to share with you some aspects of this book, especially the material on sort of how young adults, emerging adults, I'll call them, 18 to 23 year olds, think about marriage and how they negotiate sexual relationships that many of them are involved in, vis-a-vis what they think about marriage and when it's supposed to happen and what it has to do with their sexual relationships. Up until this point, my research interests have largely been in the sociology of religion, moved into the study of sexual behavior, and now I'm starting dabbling in marriage and family. So I'm going to talk about some American numbers, some Canadian numbers, and basically, like I say, some realities, what's going on, some mentalities, what are people thinking about and how do they think about this stuff, and some educated guesses about where we should expect to go in the near future. Nowhere. Okay. Here we go. Now, this is some American data, and I'll shortly get to the Canadian data, but some outside observers tend to look at the relationship scene among young adults and say, oh, this is all about hooking up, right? I mean, we hear a lot about hooking up. And we presume that the majority of emerging adults, 18 to 23 and sometimes well into the 30s, we presume that the majority of them are avoiding lasting and meaningful intimate relationships in favor of random sex. But in fact, most emerging adults do want to marry. In my own interview study, in the online college social life survey, and lots of other studies, most young men and women say they do want to get married. Not like 80%, we're talking 90, 93, 95%. Most just don't want to marry now or anytime soon. They don't feel any rush like previous generations might have. This slow but steady increase in the average age of first marriage to its present day 26 for women, 28 for men in the U.S. suggests that the purpose of dating, the purpose of cross-sex romantic relationships is changing or has changed. Most sexual relationships among emerging adults don't end in marriage. They don't end in cohabitation. They just end. And yet, ironically, plenty of emerging adults tell us they want to be married right now. In the largest data set that I use for this study, a National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent Health, well regarded in the U.S., 20% of single men between ages 18 and 23 said they would like to be married right now. 30% of women said the same thing. Among cohabitors, 50%, half of all cohabiting young women in the U.S. said they'd like to be married right now. 40% of the cohabiting men said that. So it raises the question, well, what is preventing that? Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit today about mentalities. I really think we're social creatures. We look around at each other and try to figure out what it is we're supposed to want, what it is we're supposed to do. And clearly, when cohabitation has become a very normative state, we may want marriage, but if our peers are cohabiting, well, then I guess that's what we're supposed to do. Here's some of the figures on age and marriage in Canada. From 2004, I apologize for the datedness. I'm not sure why we had trouble locating more recent numbers. I presume there are more recent numbers, but they're helpful nonetheless. Canada seems like the United States, with the earliest average ages at marriage in the heartland, right? As you see down here, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta. I tend to like to look at the medians. These are the lowest. With moving towards the coasts, you get higher average ages. And Quebec seems to be not the highest, but close to the highest. I don't know what's going on in Yukon, but they're not getting together for warmth, that's for sure. So, but for a little perspective here, in 2004, 7 years ago, Canada was at where the United States has yet to be. The U.S. age at marriage has moved up over a year, on average, in the span between 04 and 11. It doesn't mean Canada will have done so for sure. They probably did, but I'm going to talk a little bit later about that. There are reasons to believe that the average age at marriage does have a ceiling of sorts. So I'll mention that towards the end. Now, back to the United States. Shortly. Okay. Next slide, please. This is the percent of people who have never married over 40 years. Okay, so the story of marital shifts is twofold. It's not just about the rising age at marriage, because the people who are in the age at marriage statistics are still married. Okay, they get married. But the story is about people who are avoiding it altogether, okay, as well. That, too, is on the dramatic rise. Look at the American data portrayed here, especially showing this gap between 1970 and 1999. There is some action between here and there, but mostly it's in the span of 30 years, the share of young adult men, and I really focus on the 20 to 25, 25 to 29, men and women who are not married at that gap, has just exploded over 30 years. Just from 36% of men, 20 to 24, who were not married, had never married in 1970, now we're at, you know, 83 and now 89%, such that it used to be clearly a minority behavior, and now it's sort of like it is in the other direction. What kind of people, what kind of men are married before they hit 24, right? Which is ironic in the sense of, I always tell my students, The college experience is the largest, most expansive social network you'll ever be a part of. And it's not a bad place to meet somebody who you might want to marry, okay? But clearly, they're not taking that kind of advice. And here too, this is notable that 20 to 29 is basically the years of peak fertility for women. And you know, if you only want to have one or two children, typically there's time into the 30s. But, I mean, we are ignoring peak fertility when we counsel people, and I talk to my students, most of them don't even know about peak fertility, okay? One of my criticisms of the pill, and it could go in both directions, is that, you know, people don't even think about fertility anymore. They don't have to understand their own bodies when there's a pill that will magically take all that away. So, especially by 2000, there hasn't been a ton of change since then, but it's noteworthy. Next slide, please. Back to Canada. Here we have age-specific marriage rates, and I don't want to, and this is just in the span of from 2000 to 2004. My point is not going to be sort of, oh, look at that, 58.7 to 41.9, the numbers themselves, rates are often hard to understand, but my point is look at the significant change and drop in marriage rates in 4 years. Okay? 17 fewer people per thousand in just 4 years at this peak marrying age. That's for men, and this is for women. And I thought, well, maybe it's backloaded, okay? So we're not getting married in our early 20s or mid-20s. We're getting married later. But from this, it suggests that it's not backloaded because the marriage rates among the oldest in the sample also dropped over 4 years. So it's not as if we've just shifted all of this onto here. There's definitely a flight from marriage because the rates at all ranges are declining. And that was just 4 years. This can be difficult to notice out in public since we do have population growth that naturally occurs. We're all aware of marriages that are going on, there are weddings, etc. But there ought to be a steady marriage rate that reflects that, but that's not the case. In fact, it's the other way around. Next slide, please. So, why does the age at marriage rise? Okay. There's a lot of reasons for it. Being a sociologist, I tend towards the social, the structural, the economic reasons. Insofar as marriage is associated with childbearing, and that's a debatable point. We'll talk a little bit about that later. But children are no longer the producers like they were. But that's been a long time since children were producers in the same sort of sense. I mean, pre-industrial revolution era. So at some point, you would think, well, post-industrial revolution, the age of marriage should rise. Although, why did we see it in 1970 as sort of its modern lowest level, right? We also associate the 60s with the sexual revolution, okay? And people thwarting popular norms. Well, why then in 1970, 1972, 1973, why are the average age of marriage so low then? Well, in part because revolutionary mentalities and practices are really, they're minority behaviors. They take a long time to really be uptaken in the majority is what we're seeing, I suspect, more today. The second more obvious reason is, well, there's been rapid expansion in the educational and occupational opportunities for women, okay? And we can affirm that these are good things. They will, however, of course, push that age at marriage up. Another thing I talk about extensively in the book that I won't talk about too much here is the low cost or the low price of sex, okay? In a nutshell, okay? I argue that, and I'm not the first and won't be the last, that there's a sexual exchange between men and women on average. Men tend to want sex more than women do on average. And when you frame it like that, we understand that there's a pricing to sex. What does he have to do to access this thing that he wants, right? Today, not a whole lot, okay? There's reasons for that, but previous generations, he would have had to have shown more commitment, maybe earning power, etc. Well, that's generally just not the case today. The longest chapter in the book is on this pricing business. I recommend it to you. But frankly, when sex does not cost much for men to acquire, they're not going to give much, they're not going to commit much. And so it shouldn't surprise us that it is associated with a rising age at marriage. Fourth, what about the cost of living in metro areas? 20 to 30 year olds are the people who most like to live in cities and in the sort of the hippest part of cities, okay? We know this. But they're also at the point in their life course where they can least afford the kinds of places they'd like to live in, right? So thinking of marrying, thinking of childbearing, adding expenses at this time, oftentimes seems like the opposite of what they feel they need to do at that time. It does raise the question about affordable housing efforts, which, you know, the sociologist in me just, I like the idea of it. But sometimes I'm skeptical. I think that affordable housing can be sort of this, a mask for wishing to live alone. I can't afford it. I can't afford to live in this nice hip part of town by myself. Rather than marry, I want affordable housing. Okay? So I think that affordable housing doesn't improve marriage rates, although that is not an established fact. So this part structural, part cultural, and I tend to think that the structure really pushes and shapes what is cultural change. The more religious tend to want to marry earlier on average, but religiosity is associated with higher education, finishing college, and they too want to start a career. So we're seeing average age of marriage rise among more religious folks as well. And the motivations for all of this tend to be couched in a variety of cultural stories and narratives that I will share shortly. Next slide, please. So, we're avoiding marriage, but it's not like we dislike the idea. We hold it in great regard, high esteem. Maybe we even put too much esteem into it. At one level, though, it doesn't seem to be a matter of too much esteem. It's really a trade, back to that economic language. So, in the mind of the average emerging adult, I'm willing to trade my love of my autonomy, freedom to go where I want to do, hang out with my friends, etc. I'm willing to trade that if, and it's a big if, what I replace it with is clearly better. It's not the same kind of trade as it was in the past, okay? What we had, freedom and autonomy, is largely more modern, right? I mean, think about youthful marriages decades ago. They were trading relative poverty for it, right? More poverty, I think, than people tend to experience in the 20s today. So we have to recognize that people are making, in their own minds, a larger leap to trade those things for this unclear, unsure idea of marriage than their parents might have. The parents felt a lot more constrained. This is what you do. Okay? Now we have to sort of really want it bad. They also receive little help, however, in their ideas of merging marriage with other life goals. I always say, home ec was sort of done away with home economics, even though I think home economics is probably one of the most versatile sets of tools that any young person would learn, how to balance their checkbook, relational skills, all these things that we totally need far into life. We don't even offer those anymore. We train you, we give 10, 15 courses on specializations and whatever in college, and they leave college not having a clue about some of the things that they will need to do for the rest of their life. They also really received little help in understanding their early romantic relationships. I was talking with a student the other day who, even though she's from Texas, she was fairly conservative, religious, wasn't sure about marriage, didn't want to have any children. She was only 19. You might change your mind. But she had a boyfriend. I said, well, what's he for, right? What are you doing? And so and she struggled to articulate that, right? There's little help that people get into understanding their early romantic relationships and what the point of those relationships really are. Next slide, please.